Welcome all to the 9th annual Edward Said Memorial Lecture at the University of Warwick. You probably got used to seeing me here at least once a year saying this. In 2004, the Department of English and Comparative Literary Studies inaugurated the lecture series to honor Said, a distinguished literary scholar and public intellectual who died in September 2003. This year marks Said's 10th death anniversary, and although the 10th Said Memorial Lecture will take place in the next academic year, the moment perhaps offers the opportunity for a brief reflection on what organizing and attending a memorial lecture may mean. In his 1995 Tanner Lecture entitled On Lost Causes, Said had evoked an impending sense of loss that was both intensely personal and public. Said defined a lost cause as that which is associated in the mind and in practice with a hopeless cause. That is, something you support or believe in that can no longer be believed in except as something without hope of achievement. It entails either a loss of conviction, or if the sense of loss stimulates a new sense of hope and promise, a feeling that the time for it is not right, has passed, is over. In the late style of many writers that he admired, Said found a resonating sense of hopelessness. Late works for Said are, quote, so to speak, too late for the times, in the sense of superseding or transcending them. In particular, reflecting on the masterpieces of Beethoven's final decade, Said was to write, they are late to the extent that they are beyond their own time, ahead of it in terms of daring and startling newness, later than it in that they describe a return or a homecoming to realms forgotten or left behind by the relentless forward march of history. Said's death was most untimely, both in terms of how it left his emancipatory project unfinished, but also in terms of the worst possible time of the present of 2003 and the present of 2013. In other words, he died when he was most needed, his death underscoring not only his personal vulnerability, but also his inability to complete what he had anticipated and begun. But in commemorating Said's life and work in the lecture series, our intention is not to simply offer a eulogy or a sentimental remembrance, but to precisely take his unfinished project further through critique and renewal. There is no one better than today's speaker whose work, although using very different, if not oppositional, theoretical approaches than Said, has over the last several decades provided us with a systematic and daring account of the possibilities and the limits of projects of emancipation, particularly in the global South. But I will leave that to my colleague Neil Lazarus to say more about our speaker. But before I end, I would like to thank a few people who have made today's lecture possible. My colleagues in the English department, especially the research committee, Catherine Bates, our head of department, Julia Gretton, Heather Pilbin, Sorsha Gunn, Michael Sang, and Gurpreet Kaur for their enthusiastic support and help. Neil.
Thanks, Rashmi. It's a great privilege for me to be able to introduce this evening's speaker to you. I have been reading and learning from Samer Amin's work for some 40 years now, ever since as an undergraduate at the University of the Witwatersrand in the early 1970s, I chanced upon The Maghreb in the Modern World, a brilliant study of economic, social, and political conditions in three countries, Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco, in the aftermath of their decolonization. This work led me immediately to two others by Professor Amin, Neocolonialism in West Africa, which profoundly influenced the direction that my own scholarship would come to take. Among other things, the book contains one of the most lucid formulations that we have of the theory of neocolonialism, which was so important in helping to conceptualize the limits of what was everywhere being celebrated uncritically as independence, as though decolonization meant the end of external domination. And also accumulation on a world scale, a decisive contribution to the literature that was then beginning to find a wide readership on the political left under the rubrics of underdevelopment and dependency theory. I've been trying to keep up with Samer Amin's prodigious and superbly consequential writings ever since then. Accumulation on a World Scale was published in English by Monthly Review Press, the socialist publishing house that Amin has continued to furnish with titles ever since. I should explain that even though I don't have them all by any means, his books occupy the whole second shelf of one of the big units in my study. Empire of Chaos, a work published in 1992 in the wake of the first Gulf War, sets out both to historicize and explain the crisis of capitalist globalism, and also to demonstrate that no market-based solution to this crisis is possible. A humane and progressive response to the problems of the contemporary world, Amin writes, implies the construction of a popular internationalism that can engender a genuinely universalist value system, completing the unfinished projects of the Enlightenment and the socialist movement. This is the only way to build an effective front against the internationalism of capital and the false universalism of its value system. The Liberal Virus, 2004, takes this analysis further. Subtitled Permanent War and the Americanization of the World, it draws our attention to the implications of American unilateralism, whose ideological underpinnings it grasps both as an extension of historic European liberalism and as a significant departure from this earlier formation. Spectres of Capitalism, a critique of current intellectual fashions, surveys the triumphalist discourses of the post-1989 New World Order, among them postmodernism, and grounds its own critique of neoliberalism and globalization theory in a suggestive rereading of the Communist Manifesto 150 years after that book's first publication. Already in Accumulation on a World Scale and Unequal Development, an essay on the social formations of peripheral capitalism, two relatively early works, Amin had demonstrated his awareness of the need to take the capitalist world system as a necessary unit of social analysis. There are then important essays that come out of his collaboration, dialogue, and disagreements with such other major world system thinkers as Giovanni Arrighi, André Gunde Frank, and Emmanuel Wallerstein. These writings explore the dynamics of global crisis, a book of that title appeared in 1982, and the importance and limitations of anti-systemic movements. Amin's contribution to another book with Arrighi, Frank, and Wallerstein, entitled Transforming the Revolution, focuses especially on national liberation movements in the context of anti-colonial struggle. One of Amin's most incisive works is Capitalism in the Age of Globalization, a quite magisterial analysis of global, social, and political economic development since 1945, whose account both of the post-war boom, a quarter century or so of explosive economic growth accompanied in the core capitalist countries by an historically unprecedented democratization of social resources, and in the third world, by insurgent demands for decolonization and self-determination, and of the years of austerity and repression since then, the long downturn, to use Robert Brenner's term, that analysis in Amin is, to my mind, unmatched. Amin demonstrates that globalization has involved the global reassertion of US dominance, one of whose conditions of possibility was the rolling back of the challenge represented by third world insurgency, and the brutal imposition of what he calls the logic of unilateral capital. I must also mention Eurocentrism, a work that appeared in the late 1980s and that offers both a devastating critique of this ideological deformation, as he calls it, and also at the same time a stunning reconstruction of the historical record, alert above all to the centrality of Arab-Islamic civilization and culture to world history. This study is particularly relevant to our purposes this evening, since in it Professor Amin refers explicitly to the work of Edward Said. What he says in this respect is very interesting, I think, and especially telling in consideration not simply of Said's work, but of post-colonial studies at large. I quote, "The critique of Orientalism that Edward Said has produced has the fault of not having gone far enough in certain respects and having gone too far in others. Not far enough to the extent that Said is content with denouncing Eurocentric prejudice without positively proposing another system of explanation for facts which must be accounted for. Too far to the extent that he suggests that the vision of Europeans was already Eurocentric in the Middle Ages. This error by Said, which Maxime Rodinson has corrected by distinguishing earlier European versions of the Islamic Orient from those of the triumphant Eurocentrism of the 19th century, illustrates the danger of applying the concept of Eurocentrism too freely. Since the early 1980s, Professor Amin has been director of the Third World Forum in Dakar, Senegal. No mere scholar, but also an activist for all of his life, he is one of the most creative, original, and influential intellectuals on the world stage today. We are indeed honored to be able to host him at Warwick, where his presentation this evening is entitled "The Implosion of the Contemporary System, a Challenge for the Societies of the South." Please join me in welcoming Professor Samir Amin.
Good evening, all of you. Does it work?
Yes.
Yeah. Good evening, all of you, and thank you, all of you, and particularly my new friend at the University of Warwick, Varma, and others. For me, it's a honor and a pleasure to deliver this lecture. I had the privilege to discuss or to talk with Edward Said on his work. We somehow differed, but not fundamentally, in the sense that I was focusing on the historical conditions, the historical frame, associating Eurocentrism with nascent capitalism, not as a cultural phenomenon out of history, but as part of the historical building of the, let's call it, modern ideology, or the ideology of modern times. Now, I would have loved this continuing this discussion in his presence, but allow me, in his absence, I won't do it. I have also more than an admiration for the courage of Edward Said, who has been a defensor, a strong defensor of the rights of the Palestinian people. And that is no less important than his academic contributions. Now, the subject of tonight is, of my presentation is exactly what the title says, the implosion. Perhaps some people may doubt that the system is really imploding or falling apart. It is starting its implosion or falling apart. I submit that this will continue for not weeks, not months, but years, and perhaps even decades, before we can see out of this falling apart where humankind will move towards what it will move. Better or perhaps not better. Different but not better. We ought to first, my presentation will be first, what is imploding? What is that system which I submit is imploding? Second, why is it imploding? What I mean by it's being imploding. Third, what are the facets of that implosion? What are the different dimensions and how does it implode? And fourth, if we have time enough, what is to be done, as usual? Because I never try to analyze problems without coming to a political conclusion, what is to be done, or submitted for further discussion, at least. Now, first point is, what is imploding? If I ask the question, or anybody asks the question to anybody, What is the system in which we are living? The answer would be neoliberal system or market economy. These are misleading label qualifying the system. Misleading, they are ideological, as bad as, for instance, considering that what was Soviet Union? A communist society. It was something else. And therefore, we ought to qualify really the system in which we are. It's not enough to say that it is capitalist. That is so trivial, obvious. So we have to qualify the system at that stage of its evolution, of capitalism, of course. Now, I submit, because I have no other way to qualify it, I cannot summarize the qualification of this system in one word. So I use a relatively long phrase. I would say the system which is presently imploding or have started to implode is a system of generalized, globalized, financialized monopoly capital. It's a little long, but it invites us to be more precise about the characteristics of that system, and therefore give a content to each of those qualities, what I mean at least by generalized, what I mean by globalized, what I mean by financialized, what I mean by monopoly capital. Now, I start with the end, monopoly capital. This is also trivial. Capitalists have moved from industrial capitalism of the 19th century into monopoly capital as far back as towards the end of the 19th century, more than a century ago. But monopoly capital itself have not remained the same throughout a whole century. It has moved from phase to phase. And I submit that since 1975, I will be very precise, we have moved into a new phase of monopoly capital. This new phase is precisely the one which I would qualify generalized, globalized, and financialized. Generalized. Generalized, I mean by generalized that we have had, in a very short period, 15 years, between 1975 to 1990, which coincide with the breakdown of Soviet Union, and the new policy of China. We have had, throughout this very short period of 15 years, a tremendous move up of the centralization of the control of capital. And I'm very precise here. I'm saying centralization, not concentration, of the control, not of the property, of capital. That is, we had monopolies, which the usual conventional economists call oligopolies, but that's the same, see? We had them, of course. But they were, in spite of their being more or less very, very important and to some extent decisive in the designing of the economic policies of the major capitalist countries, there were an enormous area which was run by, let's say, normal capitalist enterprises, not oligopolies, not monopolies, and which were relatively autonomous from the monopolies, even if they were, of course, submitted to this or that extent to the policy dictated basically by the strongest, that means the monopolies. Now, that has changed qualitatively. And I submit that with the centralization of capital, of control of capital, and I'm making it precise, control, not property. The property, the formal juridical property, can remain terribly open. For instance, the pension funds, the owner of the pension fund juridically are the millions of workers. But in fact, the management of the pension fund is financial capital, which controls it. That is centralization of the control, of the power, not of the property. Now, to the extent that we have reached a point where there is no more, or almost no more, sector of the economic activities which is not submitted to a status of de facto, and in many cases de jure, subcontracting of monopolies. That is, the monopolies have become so strong that there is no more independent economic capitalist economic activity. They are submitted as subcontracting, and they are a good part of the surplus value produced by them is pumped out by the monopolies, by upstream and downstream control. Take the example of the agricultural family farming, capitalist, modern agriculture, not peasant agriculture of the third world, but agriculture as exists in England or in Europe or in the United States. Farmer family, modern capitalist agriculture, fully commercialized, etc., etc. Now, upstreams, who provide the credit? Monopolies. The inputs? Monopolies. Downstream, who control the commercialization? Monopolies. And through that, as is very well known, the real income at the so-called real prices, which are not real prices, there are no real prices except in the imagination of conventional economists, at those prices, the income of the farmers would be very small and indeed lower even than the wage of a worker, and perhaps even zero or negative. And it is compensated by subsidies of the state, that is of the taxpayer, that is the taxpayers are paying surplus profit for monopoly capital through that subcontracting. And this is true for almost any activity today. That is a new stage of monopoly capital. I submit, but unfortunately, I'm not alone, but we are not many, to say that it's not enough to say monopoly capital. It's a new stage, and a new stage which is terribly different from the previous stage, importantly different in that sense. Now, how, when, and how this qualitative jump was achieved? As I said, in a very short period, the system which has been a system of high growth globally, high growth in the centers of historical capitals, North America, Europe, and Japan, from 45 to 75, high growth, relatively high growth, in the so-called socialist, call it as you want, really existing socialist countries of the East, and relatively high growth a little later with the newly independent countries or having reconquered their independence in Asia, Africa, and the desarrollism of Latin America, which was something very similar. Now, that moved brutally to a crisis. By 75, the rates of growth had come down to half of what they had been on the average for the 30 previous years. And since, they have never recovered. That is a long crisis. It's not just the crisis of subprimes starting in 2008. It's a long systemic crisis. Now, how capital responded to that long systemic crisis? Precisely by this concentration of the control of capital, moving up of that control and giving to monopoly capital its new quality of being generalized. I use this word, which is common language, to say that it is general, it controls everything. Maybe somebody else will find a better way of qualifying the thing. The important is to know the content, not the wording. Now, That was one of its answers. The second answer was globalization. I'll come to it. And the third one was financialization. I'll come to it. Now, history is repeating. Because exactly a century before, when historical capitalism, as it had been built in the 19th century in Western, Central Europe, and United States, moved into a deep crisis as of 1870s, also exactly a century before, exactly, capital responded by monopoly capital, moving the first wave of centralization of control, globalization. For Africa, it was the brutal form of colonization. And that is a type of globalization. Huh? And also financialization. The City of London, the Wall Street, have not been created yesterday in response to the new crisis, but exist since the beginning of the 20th century. That is the first wave of financialization. Now, there are similarities, but differences, of course, between the first long crisis and the way it was answered by monopoly capital, by capital, and the second wave. That is how this generalized monopoly capital came to existence. Now, the other dimension was globalization. But globalization, always, globalization is not something new. André Gonde of France says that it has started 5,000 years ago. I think I do not share his view. I am always considering that the phenomena which took place within the frame of capitalism as a modern system started only 500 years ago, or perhaps even only 200 years ago with the Industrial Revolution at the economic level and the French Revolution at the political level. But anyway, and globalization has taken a variety of forms and have moved from one stage to another across history. Now, for a long time, until the 70s, one may say, perhaps the 50s only, because nothing appeared very brutally nowhere, the contrast between centers and peripheries was de facto synonymous to industrialized versus non-industrialized. Because the countries of the peripheries, starting with those countries which were so-called socialist, but also the new independent countries of Africa and Asia, and in Latin America through desarrollismo, moved into industrialization with more or less success, with problems, etc., but moved into. And that means that globalization, and today, is no more synonymous to non-industrialized countries. You cannot consider China or India or Brazil as non-industrialized. Even they are industrializing very fast. But through the control of new avenues for the control of the global system, through what I labeled or qualified the five monopolies or the five advantages, if you want to call them so, of historical central capitalism, historical imperialism, North America, Western and Central Europe, not the European Union, not Poland for sure, and Japan and some others. Moving from the monopoly of industry to the control of the access to natural resources, not the property, but the access of the planet. The control through the overprotection of so-called industrial property of technologies, particularly the most modern of it. The control of communications and so on. The control, and I'll come to that later, of the financial integrated monetary and financial system. And finally, the monopoly or the control of armament of mass destruction, nuclear and other. That is the new pattern of globalization. It is a globalization in which, through these five advantages or monopolies, the historical imperialism tried to submit the eventual development, including industrialization of the peripheries. So that is. Now, this led to the third qualification, that is financialization. But that is related to answering the question why this system is imploding, precisely because of its financialization. So I come to the second point, why is it imploding? Now, this system, so-called neoliberal in vulgar language, has produced everywhere what is obvious and recognized, very fast growing inequality, social in the distribution of income, of wealth, and so on, everywhere in the world, in the north, in the south, in the east, in the west, etc., and very fast. But that has, of course, started at least being the reason for, so let's say, social protest and even strong social protest or explosions of one kind of another everywhere in the north and in the south. But it is not until now, it is not those response of the victims of the system which are the reason for its implosion. I hope they will become it, but that's for the future. Until now, these movements remain on the defensive. That is, the initiative is still in the hands of this generalized, globalized, financialized monopoly capital, and the movements of the people, the protests, are responses, trying in some case to adjust to it, in other case to reject it, even brutally, without knowing exactly what they are rejecting and what they would place in it, would build in its place. Now, the reason for its implosion is its internal contradiction. The internal contradiction is precisely related to what is being called financialization. Here again, just as for globalization in the conventional literature is trivial to the extreme, just because people trade a little more and travel a little more and exchange messages, there is globalization. That is so trivial that it means very little. Same for financialization. That is what we ought to make clear is what is meant by financialization and why. Now, this centralization of control has led to a fast and transfer of more and more of the surplus value created by social labor everywhere on a global scale to monopoly rents, super profit maybe, but better qualified monopoly rent, with at the expense of, if not declining, stagnant, and in some cases declining, real remuneration of labor, wages, and so on, but also at the expense of normal profits of capital investments. And this is a moving down spiral, because it generates an imbalance between the global demand and the global supply. Well, the problem that Keynes met in his time, but in very, very different conditions, very different conditions, historical conditions of the 30s, but a spiral, an imbalance. And the growing, fast growing of inequality makes this imbalance growing and not being gradually reduced. Now, that means that there is a surplus of liquid capital which cannot find an investment in the widening and deepening of the productive systems. So where it has to escape, it escapes into financial investments. And the more it escapes to financial investments, the more also the imbalance grows, and therefore the down spiral continues. Now, this is the reason for Now, among the area of investments, so-called speculation on rates of interest, on rates of exchange of currencies, on everything, not only subprime for the housing, but also speculation on food, the price of basic food moving from being multiplied by 3 in a few months, perhaps even weeks in some cases, and then moving down back and so on, and speculation on everything in the present and in the future, but also in the public debt. I'll come to that point. Because the public debt is precisely wanted by generalized monopoly capital because it is an excellent area of investment, almost guaranteed. Because even if a country like Cyprus cannot pay back or cannot pay the service of the, you, the taxpayers, will pay for it through the so-called rescue or bailout of the banking system here or there. And therefore, this is the contradiction of the system, which makes the system unsustainable. I'm one of the few, I'm not alone, but we are not many, who wrote in 1991 or 92, this system, at the time it was said, end of history, a beautiful market economy forever, which will provide democracy and peace, blah, 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 etc. I was one of the few writing, this system is not sustainable. And not only for ecological reasons, there are important ecological aspect, facet of the problem, but also because of its internal contradiction. And this system is associating a zero growth to growing inequality. Now, one can not be a enthusiastic for high rates of growth in capitalism. I am not personally. But that's not the problem, because capitalism cannot survive without rate of growth, because it's the fundamental for accumulation, for reproduction of the process of accumulation. So zero growth or almost now, when a country is achieving 1.2, it is gloriously saying that it is moving out of the crisis. not at all. Huh? Zero growth associated with growing inequality means, of course, and that is the other facets, the victims are more and more and paying more and more, and the victims become the majority of the working people throughout the whole world. But it means also that this cannot be sustainable. Now, and this is financialization. It's not finance. It's not the banks and the insurance companies and the pension funds, which as institutions are controlling the whole. It's everybody. Look at the industries. Coventry was a car industry. It's no more. But look at the car industry, British or US or France or Germany. 30 years or 40 years ago, the profits were profits out of their productions of cars. Now, and only 5% from financial activities. Now it is the average is between 40 and 60%. That is the majority of the profits of car industry come not from producing cars. What is Siemens? It is a financial institution which is from time to time producing some electric products. And so on. This is financialization, and this is the... Now, the answer to... this is where stagnation or relative stagnation, zero growth or very low growth, associated with financialization means means that there is a down spiral, that the public debt grows. Now, when they say they choose austerity policy in order to reduce the debt, that is a lie, simply. They use austerity policies to have the debt growing because they need it to be growing. But they cannot say it, so they say the opposite of what they want. Huh? That is very usual in politics. Hmm? So the strategic target of the target of that strategy or of that policy is precisely the opposite of what it claims to be its target. Precisely for the reasons I gave, that the debt is an excellent opportunity for liquid excess capital to be invested with acceptable rates of interest and with de facto no risk, in spite of all the blah blah about the risk and countries falling apart and so on, because this in one way or another will be paid by the laboring people. Now, this being said, I can move fast to the third point. What are the various aspects of this implosion that is non-sustainability leading to the system falling apart or unable to. Now, this leads to what is being called market tyranny. It's not market tyranny. It's oligopoly or monopoly tyranny, because the markets are in fact shaped by the strategies of monopoly. These are not, so all the blah blah conventional economics about the real prices, the market ensuring the coming together of supply and demand, all this has nothing to do with reality. It's pure ideology. It's an imaginary system which has nothing to do with reality. Now, how this system is imploding? It is imploding, you see, at the national levels, and I would say all the national levels, for the central capitalist countries, that not the South, that is for historical imperialism, the triad, North America, Europe, and Japan, by growing imbalances between supply and demand and growing excess of liquid capital. But it reflects itself at the global level by also another imbalance, growing imbalance, between surplus and deficit countries. Surplus countries, China, Germany, Japan, deficit country, the major one, US, and many countries in between. Now, therefore, when we look at how it implodes, we can look it at all levels, national levels, but also eventually regional, like in the case of Europe, because of the existence of European Union and the subsystem of the euro, or at the global level. Now, at the national level, it is already leading to a system which cannot be run anymore in the way it has been, let's say, bourgeois democracy has been run. That is, with elections which are to some extent meaningful. Now elections are meaningless. You can vote as you want. Huh? The result is zero in any case. Huh? But this is very dangerous because it means that the credibility and legitimacy of what has been one of the basis of historical bourgeois democracy, but still democracy, is falling apart. And we can see the dangerous ideological and political consequences. But we can see it also at the regional level in the case of Europe by the falling apart of the euro system and behind it probably the European Union system. Now, I don't go into details of that because I have written a book, has been published in French, with this title, The Implosion of the Contemporary System, but not the continuation, the challenge for the South, with a chapter on that. And this book is coming in English during the summer at Pluto with in association with Monthly Review Press. So you will have it soon. And if the weather doesn't allow you to go to the beach, at least you would have something to read, among other things. But I think you would prefer, and I would prefer, the beach to the reading. Anyway, but I shall, because this leads me to the subtitle, the most important, to at global level. At global level, it means that what we can call trivial language, the North-South conflict, is growing. It is not going to be reduced. Is growing. Now, and here we find the new question of the working or the place of the emerging or so-called emerging markets or societies and the growing conflict between them and, let's say, historical imperialist centers. As one of the fundamental aspects of this implosion, or in that case, the word implosion can be criticized. It's not implosion is a very brutal thing. Eh? It is falling apart rather than implosion. Now, here we ought to be also very precise. What do we mean? Are we speaking of emerging markets or emerging countries or societies? This is very different. The World Bank is interested only in emerging markets. They cannot understand what is a nation, what is a class, what is a society. They understand only what is a market. And in the frame of their unrealistic vision of the market. But anyway, that is opportunities precisely for this excess surplus of liquid financialized capital to move here and there through delocalization of industries, through plunder of natural resources, through land grabbing, through everything, and through speculation, as we have seen with the financial crisis of 98 for Southeast Asia or Russia, and as we have seen with Mexico, and as we will see again and again. No, we have emerging markets of that kind, provided that they operate within a society, within a political power, which accepts, submit to the new international division of labor, that is, submit to the five advantages of monopolies, submit to making the natural resources accessible, playing within the integrated monetary and financial global market, through etc., and at the political level, accepting the military control of the planet by the U.S. and behind them the Europeans, but just as secondary allies. In that case, yes, we have. Relatively fast expanding, zero growth on one side, and 5% growth. And that is, to a large extent, the case of India or Brazil or many other countries. They are expanding markets. But expanding emerging society is something else. Implies a sovereign project which precisely enters in conflict with those five advantages, which questions the access, the exclusive access to natural resources for to the benefit of historical imperialism, which question the monopoly on technologies, and not just import technologies, but develop a capacity of absorbing it, reproducing it, and perhaps even developing it, which does not play within the globalized, financialized monetary system, etc. Now, that is a sovereign project. A sovereign project is something else than submitting to the five monopolies of the five advantages. It is precisely questioning. If we look, if we take this criterion for distinguishing a emerging society from an emerging market, then we have one, China. That means that we have something very different. It's not China plus India, the BRICS and the BRACs, and I don't know what. No, these are different, very different. It means a sovereign project which walks on two legs. One is building an industrial modern with much of capitalism, for sure. I'm not speaking of socialism. I'm speaking of sovereign project. But building a system, an integrated and in a systematic way, industrial system. That means planning, not in the bureaucratic sense, but the planning in China. I mean, China is not successful because it has moved into globalization, but it is successful because it controls its belonging, its moving into globalization. That is very different. Or attempting to control it, there is nothing perfect. Control it, more or less, but control it. And the other leg is that precisely in order for that, the building of that systematically building of an industrial modern system, in order to make it possible, food sovereignty, that is not security, food sovereignty, that is patterns of development of food and agriculture and therefore rural areas, which can guarantee, provide and guarantee the food for all, which means a mastering to a certain extent the transfer from rural to urban areas. Now, China is mastering that to a certain extent, not absolutely, but to a large extent. India is not. Egypt is not. Brazil is already completely urbanized, so problem belongs to the past. Countries of Africa are not. This is why you can see the transfer from rural to urban areas not associated with growing food sovereignty, but on the opposite of it, growing food dependency. And this is the case for Africa, not the case for India, but the case for Africa, not the case for Brazil, of course, but the case for many countries in the south. And I would say for India, it's not the case for India at the level of the Indian Federation, but at the level of regions, it is obviously that. So what you have here, apart from, then in between, let's say we take the two end of the spectrum, China, potentially Vietnam, but we are not yet there, but potentially for the same political reasons also and history. And at the other end, I would say Africa, the Arab countries, which are those which have not moved seriously into industrialization during the previous long crisis and therefore find themselves in I'm calling again lumpen development, taking from André Goudefranc, who used the word in another set of circumstances. It's not a reproduction of it, but I think that the qualification is quite nice. You can have, in India, high rates, half of China, but still not bad, and much better than the West, associated with growing pauperization. So you have emerging market and growing pauperization simultaneously, or lumpen development, and so on. Now, that is the challenge. Now, I conclude, because I should conclude, if I had 1 hour or more, I would devote my time to that conclusion, because it's the main point. What is to be done? Now, I shall restrict myself to the South, because it's the title also, and not to, but what is to be done is a question no less relevant for the North, but different. Now, in a one sentence, I would say audacity. That if there is not within a visible future, not weeks and months, decades, a renaissance, a renewal of a radical left, able to face the challenge with a positive, a consistent alternative, a capacity to build the alternative historical block of social classes, forces, and so on, a diversity. A historical block, I would call it for the South, an anti-imperialist, anti-comprador, taking the old vocabulary, but with a new content. Now, that is that is the challenge. Now, you know, and that would be my concluding observation. Many people say, this is very commonly said, well, the crisis is global, the answer is global. The response should be global. No. The question is global, the answer is deconstructing that globalization in order to create the conditions for eventually reconstructing it differently. Imagining that you can change the system from the top is at best very naive illusions. Through a meeting where? In the UN, in the G20, you don't know where, to change the world. The world doesn't change that way. It changes from the bottom, through struggles, which change things partly and create, through chaos in many cases, new balance of forces. And that gradually also changes the balance of force at global level or at regional level. Now, we are, in that sense, entering into, it's a little pretentious, perhaps, a little dangerous to say it in that way, but I would be careful, a revolutionary period. It doesn't mean that there is, I don't believe in the revolution with capital R, which gives a final solution to all problems of humankind. The next morning you are in heaven after coming out of hell. But in revolutionary advances. And I think that what has been throughout the ages, revolutions were rather revolutionary advances than more than that. Revolutionary period in that sense, that first, the dominated classes everywhere in the North and the South accept less and less their domination. That is, the system is losing its credibility, legitimacy, including the parliamentary representative electoral system in the North, in the West, but including a caricature of it in many places elsewhere. And that is one. The other is that the ruling classes cannot continue ruling with the pattern of rules that they, with which they have ruled successfully. That is, they are losing their legitimacy. You see, generalized monopoly capital means a tremendous change in society. The bourgeoisie, as they had historically existed, made up of millions of families, not only individuals, usually men, but families at least, located somewhere related to local politics, owners of some assets, real assets here, and so on, is disappearing to the benefit of what Marx had seen as abstract capital. It's capital which is, where is this capital? Everywhere and nowhere. That means a concentration, centralization of power to an oligarchy. Now we have a few thousand, hundreds of thousands, maybe that's a very small figure, of individuals who are controlling everything, deciding for everything. And this is the opposite of what historical democracy has been, which meant a room for social compromises, historical compromise in the Italian language, just as real social democracy was when it was social democracy. Now it's social liberalism, social I don't know what, social is nothing, non-social liberalism. So that is the very dangerous point in which we are in history, and I don't know how it will be, what the answer will be given. But I would say, look at the first long crisis of capitalism. What was the answer? The answer was a series of negligible events: World War I, the Russian Revolution, the restoration of the 20s, the crisis of the 30s, Nazism, Imperial Japan, the Second World War, the Chinese Revolution. These were the answers, historical answers. They were not negotiation within the G20 or I don't know what. They were not, it was not even Keynes. I mean, Keynes, what he wrote was very respectable but not understood until the social conditions were created by those small events which the conventional economists ignore. This is not economics. It's not the market. It's something else. But this was the answer. I don't think that history repeats itself in the same format, but we have entered a period of that kind. That is a period of, let's call it, wars and revolutions, if you call it them so. And if I had more time, I could go in some examples of that, but I'm compelled to stop at that point, and thank you. Now, if there are some...
I wish we had another hour to hear your conclusion, but hopefully some of the issues will come up in the questions or discussion. If you have,
yeah. Maybe let me try. You require a piece of paper.
Yes, I'd like to know your opinion about Venezuela and what Chavez has done, and whether you see a way forward for the whole of South America.
um,
Yes, perhaps.
Okay.
Yes.
Hello. Thank you very much for your talk. My name is Nicola Pratt. I'm an associate professor in the Politics and International Studies Department at Warwick. I guess my question is a bit obvious, but do you then see the so-called Arab Spring or Arab revolutions as part of this revolutionary period?
Yeah, I can hear.
My question has to do with Monsanto and Haiti's response when Haiti burned all the seeds that Monsanto donated, mm-hmm. and
yeah.
how you see that working into the solution.
Yeah. Okay, perhaps. Yeah, you are exactly asking me to develop my last point, which I had no time to develop. But if you allow me, we'll take one more hour. And perhaps we can move ahead in the answers. Now, there has been revolutionary advances in South America, indeed, in my opinion. Revolutionary advances, which still are very vulnerable, full of limits and contradictions, but which are advances of different kind, starting from Brazil, but also Argentina and Uruguay in their way, Venezuela, Bolivia, and Ecuador. Not to speak of Cuba, of course, and not to speak of some indications in Central America with Nicaragua and so on, and not to speak for potential things happening elsewhere in Latin America. Revolutionary advances, they are different from one country to another, very different, because the history, the social and economic background is different. Now, my friend François Houtard classifies the countries of Latin America today in four groups. Those who accept operating in the frame of the global generalized financial capital, Mexico or Colombia, with no, not questioning. Those who are questioning it, but in the frame of a non-sovereign project, but an attempt to adjust to their benefit to the global system by moving ahead their industrial capacities. Brazil, with a policy of redistribution of income, nothing more, to the benefit, to reduce the growing inequality associated with the mechanism of that system. And perhaps in different historical conditions, Argentina and Uruguay are close to that. Then you have the countries where, I'll come to Venezuela last, the countries where there has been a strong popular, the Arab would call it revolution, of course, but this is at least a strong, real popular movement, which reflected in elections, and for a, which is not very common that the popular movement win the elections, Bolivia and Ecuador. And the case of Venezuela, which had started because Chavez was the first elected. But in a country which is not only dependent on oil, but nothing but oil. That is, the historical process has destroyed Venezuela. Destroyed. There is no agriculture in Venezuela. It has disappeared completely because of oil. There are no industries. The whole system, I'm exaggerating a little, but the whole system has tended throughout the 50 previous years to the 15 last ones, of reducing the country to be an oil company and nothing else, with redistribution of the rent oil. Now, there are two patterns. The old one, redistribution to billionaires, the middle class completely corrupted. You know, I was always scandalized in Venezuela, seeing university professors having a villa of 200 hectares, I don't know, gigantic, 5 cars, 10 servants, etc., that you don't have in Britain, huh? For sure. Now, replaced by another pattern of redistribution, which I have sympathy with, for the poor. But now, how to move, that is a revolutionary advance, but how to move from that to building, not rebuilding, building an economy. Now, that is the challenge, and this is the vulnerability of the whole thing. Yeah? Now, the Arab revolutions, well, you can read my book. It's in English. It was published by Fahamu Books, Oxford, last year. The Arab Revolutions, or the future of the Arab Revolutions, I don't remember the title exactly, which says the following. The first chapter is an analysis more of Egypt than other countries, while I also consider other countries because I'm Egyptian and I think it's I know a little better perhaps or Egypt than other countries. That was an explosion. Now, you know, just a year before, in 2010, the World Bank had given the certificate of honorability and success to Mubarak for his gigantic progress in economy. Everybody laughed at it in Egypt and said, we never saw it. We never saw it. But the experts of the World Bank had seen it, this miracle. Now, what we had in the Arab countries, you know, the Arab countries in the era of Bandung, particularly from 55, say, to 75 or 70, during 10, 15 years, whether Nasiri and Egypt, the Baath of the time of Syria and Iraq, not of today or yesterday, the Boumediene in Algeria, and also, I would say, even if they would not be completely similar, Bourguiba in Tunisia, what I call national popular, not populist, popular, not demagogic, but achieving from above to the benefit of the popular classes, but preferably also of the middle classes. You see, something very balanced. Eh? And excluding the self-organization of the people, but giving them, which gave a legitimacy. Once that system has come out of steam, having achieved and achieved things positive, and gigantic things positive in terms of education, health, etc., etc., came out of steam, then the same ruling class, ruling group, in order to remain in office, accepted to submit to neoliberalism. That coincided in the case of Egypt with the death of Nasser and coming of Sadat and of later of Mubarak. That coincided with the death of Boumediene. That coincided with the internal coup of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, of Hafez al-Assad, the father, in Syria. And all of them moved into, and there was an Arabic word for that, infitah, opening, yeah? But uncontrolled opening, not controlled opening Chinese way, uncontrolled opening. And that has led to a very fast social destruction with massive unemployment, but more than that, massive urban middle class, younger, educated, semi-educated unemployment, and things of that kind. And pauperization, growing inequalities with a new class of comprador billionaires, along with this process of lumpen development. That was the miracle that the World Bank loved. That was exploding. I mean, when it exploded, in the case of Egypt, in 25th of January 2011, that was not a surprise. It was expected since years and years. There is a documentary film which had been produced before by Amal Ramses, an Egyptian woman documentarist, which ends with "The revolution is coming," the last sentence. And the title of this documentary is "We Disobey." And it shows how the Egyptian society is disobeying to the logic and the orders. The system is becoming more and more police, but in spite of being police, is disobeyed more and more. So now, simultaneously, when the ruling class itself went out of steam with the national popular system and joined and submitted to the so-called neoliberal new pattern, they opened the way to political Islam as the only way of fighting potential left lato sensu, popular left. And that was systematically done, in the case of Egypt, by Sadat and continued by Mubarak, with the systematic support of the US in particular, and Europe behind as usual. And elsewhere, the same. Now, that was, the two went together. I'm speaking of political Islam, because be careful about that. It is not a religious movement. It is a political reactionary party, anti-democratic by nature, and completely accepting the submission in the name that private property is holy in Islam, generalities of that kind, that you can apply for Christianity, for any religion or no religion. You can be pro-market and atheist, and you can be pro-market and good Christian or good Muslim or good anything else. So it's reactionary part. Now, then what happened, and I'll take the case of Tunisia and Egypt, or I'll start with Egypt. In the case of Egypt, the movement started with a revolt of the urban young, of the lower middle classes close to the popular classes, and joined immediately. Well, it was 1 million, 2 million people the first days, and the fifth days was 15 million people. 15 million people in the streets is not a small figure. It means the whole country. And it means also, and that was preceded by gigantic working class strikes starting in 2006, that 5 years before. The most important strikes on the whole African continent since 50 years. Roughly, not together, 4 million workers went on strikes. With, for the first time, in spite of the repression, some small success. I mean, capital being compelled to withdraw a little and state. And the peasant movement resisting to the accelerated expropriation associated with neoliberalism and land grabbing, to the benefit of the rich peasants, the same process as in India and elsewhere. And of course, a lot of different democratic parties of the middle classes. I am not saying of the bourgeoisie, of middle classes, educated middle classes, lawyers, doctors, engineers, these and those, education people, etc., etc. And at that point in time, the Muslim Brotherhood took position against the movement, with the government, with Mubarak, because they were expecting, just as Mubarak, that, okay, we'll crush them, we'll succeed. Now, once the movement mobilized 15 million people, then the balance of force has changed. The US changed their strategy instead of supporting get rid of Mubarak, and instead and opened the way to what Obama himself said, we want an orderly, short transition with fast elections, which is elections in order not to support the movement, but to stop it. That is very often frequent in history, to use elections to stop a movement, which would move ahead if time is given to it. And that brought the Muslim Brotherhood in office, which are exactly continuing the same policy as Mubarak. Nothing changed. Nothing. The walls of Cairo say it beautifully. And everywhere it's written on the walls. The revolution has not changed the regime, but it has changed the people. That is, now we understand. So we are moving into a period of long chaos, unsustainability. This system is not sustainable. Same with Tunisia. I was a few days ago in Tunisia for the World Social Forum, and we have something very, very similar with the Nahda, which are the Muslim Brotherhood of Tunisia, won fast elections because the wide mass of people who do not understand much in politics and which there was no time for them to be mobilized in struggles and through mobilization struggles getting their own education could fall into the trap of electing those who in the name of religion, blah, blah, will provide soon the heaven. So, that is the Arab Revolution today. My chapter, what I could add on to the first chapter, which was written last year, published last year, would be, and I have written papers that you can find on Pambazuka News about the evolution with the elections. Now, Monsanto is a very good example of how monopolies control completely agriculture in the West and in the South, in the North and in the South, and pump out. There are also the terrific destructive or potentially destructive effects and anti-ecological and anti-everything, with no mastering of what it could produce, but also at a economic financial level, the way of pumping value created by labor, peasant labor in that case, or capitalist modern farmers' labor, to monopoly rent of Monsanto and others. So I think they should be rejected not exclusively also on ecological grounds, but also on the, all the blah blah on real prices. What is real prices of food when it is squeezed by monopolies upstream and downstream as it is. by Monsanto, among others.
Maybe last couple of questions.
So the setting of this revolutionary critique today is the university, and the setting of where many of us work is the university. And as you were talking about the generalized, globalized, financialized monopoly capital, I was hearing also in my mind where I've been seeing the university system going, not only in the UK, but in the US and Europe. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that, about applying that to the university system, and what that will do to us who are trying to produce this critique inside the system that is slipping quickly into the system we're talking about.
Yeah, you see, the logic of the system is to destroy the universities as they have been historically, to turn them into business schools. I mean, schools producing the people so-called needed by the so-called market. And this is their language, by privatizing, by associating it with the so-called demand of labor, with private interests, and destroying the curricula of the areas where the target of the university was to reinforce capacity of being critical, that is, and to be totally uncritical and just an executive to produce executives to execute the orders, and not able to understand what is the system that they are managing. That is, I mean, the so-called crisis of the university is not a crisis. It's a plan of destruction of change, which goes along with the destruction of democracy. Democracy, even if it is limited by capitalism and bourgeois property and so on, democracy goes along with critical thinking, capacity to be critical, to analyze a system and eventually to develop various theories and various ways of looking at reality. If you destroy that, you destroy democracy. That is what makes meaningless. I mean, then voting will be voting on the face of people. This man or this woman looks better than the other, speaks better, or I don't know what, without any reference to any program or critical analysis of a system and proposals. Now, it's part of the destruction of democracy.
Okay. On that hopeless and hopeful note, I'd like to extend a very warm thank you.
You know, in Iraq, the Americans have done that on a terrible scale. The university, the programs for, not primary, but secondary schools and university, are only two subjects, two, business and religion. Full stop. That is destroying.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.